we're just going to do a lot of those sort of definitions, get them out of the way, and then we'll have a lot more machinery available to us in the afternoon to start looking at how we estimate things, methods like least squares and maximum likelihoods, which are very commonly used in the physical sciences. So, I'm going to begin by, again, another example of something that's perhaps seems a bit far away from the physical sciences. It's to do with a set of propositions like rolling a die or tossing a coin, but we'll quickly move on to considering random variables which are continuous. In other words, the sorts of ways that you would characterize physical systems by their temperature, their pressure, their volume, their density, things like that. Okay, so let's suppose, first of all, that we're in that more artificial situation where you've got a set of m propositions, and this first statement here is just saying that if they're all mutually exclusive, you know, one can be true at a time, but all the others have to be false, then if you sum all of those probabilities together, then you get one. But suppose you've got another proposition, let's call it y. Well, Bayes' theorem tells us how we can combine probabilities. So the probability of x1 being true, given that y is true, is this term here. It's the conditional probability. And we can combine that with this p of y to give us the joint probability of x1 and y both being true. And you can do the same thing for all of these m propositions. And then you can sum them. So if you sum those conditional probabilities, you have to get 1 because you're summing over all the possible xk outcomes from k equals 1 to m. And they are all mutually exclusive and exhaustive, so they exhaust all the possibilities. So they have to sum to 1. And that means that we can define what's left, this p of y given I, given background information I, we can define that as what we call the marginal probability. So what we've done is we've marginalized over all possible values of xk, and what we're left with is a statement now about the other quantity y. So p of y is the marginal probability where we've summed over all possible xk outcomes. And what's much more natural for the physical sciences is to do that kind of thing, but for a continuous variable. A variable like, as I said, temperature, pressure, volume, mass, whatever it might be. And there, where x can take infinitely many values, what we do is we don't sum, we integrate. So you integrate the joint probability of x and y over x. And we call this marginalization. But p of xy is no longer a probability, it's what we call a probability density. So it only really makes sense to talk about that in terms of its integral from a certain value to another certain value from a to b. So if you integrate p of xy from a to b with respect to x, then that's giving you the joint probability that x lies between a and b and y is true. And you can do the same kind of integration over y values if you want to. So we also should have that p of x given y, when you integrate over all possible values of x, you should get 1. And that's often referred to as a normalization condition. Again, terminology that is borrowed in other areas of physics as well, like say in quantum physics, where you have the normalization of certain operators. So it's the same idea. It just means that x has to be something. So if you integrate x over all possible values it could have, then you have to get 1 for the probability. Now, depending on what x is, it might only make sense physically to define it for positive values of x. Let's say x is a temperature, you don't get negative temperatures. Well, actually, it's an extraordinarily bad example because you do get negative temperatures on the Celsius scale, but you don't get them on the Kelvin scale. So if you take x being Celsius temperature, then the probability density function would only be defined for positive values of x. But you can still talk about doing the integration from minus infinity to plus infinity, and you just set the integrand to be 0 over the negative range. So often that's just a notational thing which is done in many textbooks and examples, is that they will keep the range from minus infinity to plus infinity, even if the PDF itself is only defined over a subset of that range. Probabilities are never negative, pretty much just said that. But the other point that means is that you can regard the integral of the probability density function, which you would represent graphically as the area under the curve, as the probability of x lying between A and B. Many of you, if not all of you, will probably have met these ideas before, so we're going through them reasonably fast. I imagine also that most of you will have come across the Poisson distribution before as well. So let's just say a few words about that and use it as a way to introduce some more of our notation. So in many physics problems, in many physical sciences problems, what we're doing is counting things. And the Poisson probability density function is a very good model for that kind of situation, subject to certain assumptions. The assumptions being that the counts, the detections, are independent of each other, and that there's some rate at which you can expect detections to arrive, which is constant. It's a parameter, maybe called mu here. So the probability density function for a Poisson distribution tells us the probability that you would detect R events, or counts, or detections, given an expected rate mu. And this is what it looks like. It's mu to the R, e to the minus mu over R factorial. So if we graph that, well, first of all, it's easy to show that if you sum the P of R's for R equals 0 to infinity, then they sum up to 1, so it's properly normalized. And, well, the Poisson PDF, if you do a graph of it, it looks like this. So this is actually three examples. It's examples for different values of mu. So if you expect the rate to be only 0.5, now what are the units of this? Well, it depends on the problem. If it's a rate of arrival of photons, say, from a source, it could be a star, it could be a radioactive source, could be something like that, then it would be the number of events per unit time, per second or per hour, per week, whatever it might be. So 0.5 wouldn't be a very high rate. And in fact, what you see is that for the Poisson distribution, there's a quite high probability that you would get zero events in your given time interval. If the expected rate is 0.5, then there's a probability of about 60% that you might actually only get zero. Then if mu is 1, then what happens is that there's a higher probability of getting a larger number of events, but eventually the probability of getting a very large number of events becomes negligible. And then if mu was, say, 5, what you start to see is a sort of bell-shaped curve. So whereas for very low values of mu, the form of the Poisson is like an exponential, for large values of mu, it starts to look more like a bell shape, which, again, I'm sure many of you have come across this many times before. It's what we call a Gaussian or a normal distribution. We'll come to that in a minute. Another PDF that's quite important is called the binomial PDF. And this, the archetypal example, not that it's got anything much to do with physics, would be tossing a coin where there's two possible outcomes, a head or a tail. And if you have n observations and you have r successes, where success is defined, for example, to be a head, then the probability of getting r heads out of n coin tosses is the binomial distribution. It's n factorial over r factorial, n minus r factorial, times theta to the r, 1 minus theta to the n minus r. And theta here is a parameter. It's the probability of success for a single observation. So if you toss a coin and you think it's a fair coin, then theta should be 0.5. But it might not be. It might be a biased coin. And we'll look this afternoon at a Bayesian example of how you can test from a series of data whether the coin is in fact fair. And you can see how the posterior for theta, the parameter of the binomial distribution, evolves as you get more and more data. Again, we can show that it's properly normalized. Moving to continuous random variables, well, the simplest one, the one that maybe intuitively people often think of, is a uniform PDF. It's where every value is equally probable. So if every value between A and B is equally probable, then the normalization condition, it's got to integrate up to 1, means that the PDF has to be 1 over B minus A. So it's just a horizontal line at that value, and then the area under that curve between A and B is equal to 1. And then we have the normal distribution that we mentioned before. So the Poisson distribution was starting to look like this shape for large mu, and that's a well-known result, that if you have large number counts, large numbers of events, then the Poisson distribution starts to look like a normal distribution. And this is the functional form that the normal distribution takes, 1 over square root of 2 pi sigma, e to the minus a half, x minus mu over sigma squared. So we call that the normal distribution with mean mu, and sigma is known as the standard deviation, or sometimes the dispersion. So here's two example normal distributions, one with a sigma of 0.5 and one with a sigma of 1. They're both centered on x equals mu. And we'll be meeting the normal distribution a great deal over these 2 days. You can define something called the cumulative distribution for any PDF. It's the probability that the variable, in this case let's call it x, is less than some value, in this case let's call it a. So P, capital P of a, is the probability that x is less than a. Sometimes you see it as less than or equal to a, it really doesn't matter, because the probability of it being exactly a is formally zero, because you can only define probability over a finite range. So sometimes you see it as a less than, sometimes you see it as a less than or equal to, not worth getting too worried about. So here's the cumulative distribution for two normal PDFs, the ones we saw before, and the one with the larger sigma has a more shallow slope as the CDF increases. Because basically, any probability density function, its equivalent CDF, is going to go from 0 to 1. The question is just how rapidly does it go from 0 to 1? If it goes very steeply from 0 to 1, then that means you've got quite a concentrated PDF. It's quite tightly concentrated around its mean value. If the PDF is more spread out, then the CDF will increase more gradually. But sooner or later, it will reach 1, because the probability of x being less than infinity has to be 1. So here's the first of our multi-choice questions, our little pop quiz questions, just to keep you on your toes and to keep Super Central happy that I'm giving you some form of assessment. So you've got 4 figures here. The blue curves show a normal distribution with mean 0 and standard deviation sigma 1. And I'm looking for which one of the pink curves shows a normal distribution with mean 0 and standard deviation sigma equals 0.5. So is it A, B, C, or D? So there'll be a chance to go back over the questions at the end of tomorrow if people want to look at them again, but I suggest we'll maybe move on at this point. That's your first question, first pop quiz question. Right, so for any PDF you can define different ways of characterising them. Again, I'm hoping this is a little bit of revision for many of you. You can define, for example, what we call the moments, and that's the expected value of x to the power n, which you can either represent if it's a discrete random variable by just a sum, or if it's a continuous variable by an integral. So whatever the PDF is, P of x, if you multiply that by x to the power n and integrate, that's you got the nth moment of the PDF. Now, if you already knew what the PDF was, you might well say, well, what do I need to work out the moment for? But in reality, where this comes about is that We don't know what the PDF is, but you can measure certain quantities, which you can identify as the moments of that distribution, and they can help you to work out what the PDF is, to work out an appropriate functional form for it. Again, we'll see that in action. You've probably done that kind of thing yourself already, like calculating an average of some data and then fitting that to a normal distribution with that as the mean of the data that you observed. So the first moment would be that case. It would be called the mean or the expectation value. So it's often denoted by these angled brackets, or sometimes you see it as an X with a bar over it. And that mean value is quite simply just the average of a set. So that would be an estimate of the mean would be that you take your observed data and you just add them all up and you divide by the number of data points. It's called the sample mean. We'll look at that more specifically in a short while. So the formal definition of the first moment is the integral of x times px dx from minus infinity to plus infinity. And then the second moment is called the mean square. So the formal definition of that for a continuous variable is the integral of x squared times p of x, with the equivalent definition for a discrete variable. And the variance is defined as, it's a bit of a mouthful to say, but it's reasonably easy to read. It's the expectation value of x minus the expectation value of x all squared. So what you do is you take x minus its mean, you square that, and you integrate that for all values of x weighted by the PDF, p of x. That's the variance. It's often written as sigma squared, and sigma, the standard deviation, is the square root of sigma squared. And in general, you can show that the variance of any quantity x is equal to the expected value of x squared minus the expected value of x all squared. So that's a kind of straightforward way to evaluate the variance in certain cases. So here's a little table. I mean, don't bother going scribbling this down. I'm hoping you're not spending too much time scribbling any of this down, because all the material will be available for you afterwards. But this is just a kind of a reference table to let you see what the means and variances are for the four distributions that we've introduced so far. There's the Poisson, the binomial, the uniform, and the normal. And for a normal PDF, the higher order moments can be defined to be zero. So in other words, you can set things up so that the only parameters you need to specify for the normal distribution are the value of mu and the value of sigma. Well, that figures, because if you look at the mathematical form of the PDF, those are the only two things that appear. It's just pi, but that's a constant. So a normal distribution is uniquely defined by its mean and its standard deviation. So the median is another way to characterize any distribution, and it's not to do with the PDF, but to do with the cumulative distribution function, the CDF. The median divides the CDF into two equal halves, because the CDF will always go from 0 to 1. The question is just how rapidly it gets there. So there will be a value of x for which the CDF is equal to a half. That means the probability of x being less than that value is equal to a half, and the probability of x being greater than that value is also equal to a half. So in some sense, it's the middle of the distribution. We call it the median, and you can define that for any distribution you like, but for the case of a normal distribution, the median coincides with the mean. All that's saying is that the normal distribution is symmetrical about the mean. There's just as much area to the left of the mean as there is to the right. So that's the defining characteristic of the median for any distribution, and the picture shows the median for this particular distribution, in fact two of them, two normal distributions with different sigmas. So here's the second question. Now, the bit of physics this is drawn from is my area, it's astrophysics, but frankly the fact that it is really irrelevant, because it's just testing whether you've got the hang of what the median is defined to be. So what I've done here is I've listed 15 data values. These happen to be something that we call the absolute magnitude. It's related to the logarithm of luminosity for galaxies. So if you make a list of the brightest galaxy in 15 different distant galaxy clusters, these are the numbers. And they're arranged from brightest to faintest, because the way it works for absolute magnitude is that the more negative the number, the more bright that object is. So these are the absolute magnitudes of the 15 objects from brightest to faintest, and I want to know what the sample median value is. So the median is formally defined as the value that divides the PDF into two equal halves. Now we don't have a PDF, we just have a list of 15 values, but they're arranged in such a way that you have the brightest first and the faintest last. So what do you think the median is? Okay, again, hopefully that isn't too taxing if you fill in your answer in your grids. Then the final measure we're going to introduce for now is the mode. It's the value of x for which the PDF is maximised. So, for example, the Gaussians that we considered before peak when x equals mu. So, in fact, for a normal PDF, a Gaussian, so I've used those terms interchangeably, the mean and the median and the mode are all the same. They're all equal to mu, the parameter mu. Okay, so a few more bits and pieces that we want to add to our sort of mathematical toolbox to use this afternoon. And we can define not just the variance of a random variable x, but the variance of a function of that random variable. So if you've got f of x, f is some function of x, and you want to know what the variance of f of x is, then there's a simple expression that one can use to write that down. It can be approximated to second order by this expression here, that the variance of f of x is equal to the variance of x times df by dx all squared, evaluated at the mean value of x. I've written that with the over line notation, x bar. So if you've met any of this stuff before as undergraduates, it's probably been in the context of labs, where you're working out an error on a measured quantity, and then you're using that measured quantity to maybe work something else out, like you measure the temperature and you've got to work out the temperature to the fourth power. And you want to know what the error on t to the fourth is. So what you were probably given is some kind of simple formula to do that. And that formula would be based on this second order approximation. What maybe didn't happen is that maybe nobody bothered to explain where it comes from. And at the time you might have thought, well, so what, I'll just use the formula they've given me and not worry about it. But where this formula comes from is from a Taylor expansion of f of x. So what you're doing is you're truncating that Taylor expansion at second order. Now that might be fine. There might be no problem in doing that because the higher order terms aren't large. But if the higher order terms are large, then not only can this have an effect in that you get the wrong value of the variance, but it can result in a kind of a systematic error, like I mentioned in the first section, that no matter how many times you repeat your measurements, you're always going to get a systematic error in your value of the variance. Now again, maybe you already know all this, these sorts of issues have been brought to your attention as undergraduates, I hope they have, but my experience of lab teaching as a student myself wasn't anything like that. They just kind of told us what to do and said, don't ask questions. Now you're at the stage where you've got to ask questions because you've got to worry about the things that even your supervisor hasn't worried about. Because when it comes to your viva, it's going to be you against your external and internal examiner, and you'll be expected to defend what you've done and how you've done it. So, did anyone here take the introductory data analysis course? Okay, a few people did, but not that many. So, if you did, then I think this was probably covered there, but I was expecting there'd be quite a lot of people coming to this course that hadn't done the introductory course before, so I thought it was worth mentioning this again. Now, what we'll do tomorrow is we'll introduce a kind of an extension to this, quite a powerful method that allows you to transform not just the variance of a random variable to a function of that random variable, but the whole PDF. In other words, if you've got a numerical code that can sample random variables from one sort of distribution, like a uniform or a Poisson, then we'll look at how you can transform those random numbers that your computer spits out at you so that they are effectively sampled from a different PDF. And that's the key to some of the powerful methods that are now used to do data analysis on very complex problems, maybe with many dimensions, many parameters that you're trying to estimate, one example of which is this Markov chain Monte Carlo that I've mentioned. So we'll be looking at a lot of that tomorrow afternoon. So here's the third of our pop quiz questions. Now this one's a little bit tricky, but this will get you thinking about that expression. In fact, we'll just flash that expression up one more time. Variance of f of x is the variance of x times df by dx squared. So what I'm asking you to do is to write down an expression which correctly approximates the error on the natural logarithm of a variable. So if you know what sigma x is, and the function is the log of x, then what would the error sigma on log of x be? Would it be sigma x squared over x squared? Would it be x squared times sigma x squared? Would it be sigma x over x, or x times sigma x? So this one's a bit trickier. You might actually have to write some maths down for this one. But it's using that same formula that we saw in the previous slide. And provided sigma x isn't too large, this approximate formula is actually pretty good. And there are many fields in the physical sciences where this approximation is used. Okay. Right, let's move on then. That's question three. Right, next thing we want to add to our toolbox is multivariate distributions. Everything I've said about random variables x, we want to be able to write down similar things for situations where you've got x and y and z and any number of random variables all considered together. In fact, the way I've written the notation here is that our random variables are x1 and x2. So if you want to work out the probability of x1 being between a1 and b1, and x2 being between a2 and b2, then what you do is you take the joint PDF and you integrate over x1 and x2. Now the sharp-eyed amongst you might be worrying a bit as to why x1 and x2 appear as capitals on the left-hand side. To be honest, as physicists or physical scientists, you don't really need to worry about that. This is an aspect of notation that's really just for the mathematical purists. It's because in a strict frequentist interpretation of probability, x1 is a random variable over here, whereas it's like a specified number over here. So when it's a random variable, we give it a capital letter because we haven't given it an assigned number yet. But once we assign what the number is, then we make the distinction by turning the capital letter into a small letter. Now, if you're a Bayesian, you have a much more relaxed interpretation of what random variables are and what parameters are and what fixed numbers are and what not unfixed numbers are. So generally, you'll find in most Bayesian textbooks that they don't bother with that notation, but in a lot of classical frequentist probability textbooks, they do stick with this capital letter notation when it's a random variable. So, as a concession to my mathematics tutors in my undergraduate degree, where they did drum all this stuff into me, I thought I would at least sometimes put the capitals in to keep them happy. So we can extend to more than two random variables in the obvious way. And that means that we can define things called marginal distributions, which we touched on earlier anyway. The marginal PDF of x1 is the joint distribution of x1 and x2 integrated over x2. In fact, if you want to be really pernickety, you can write that as p1 of x1, but most of the time I'll just drop that subscript 1 notation, just keep it as simple p. It's a PDF in the usual sense. It's strictly positive or non-negative. It's such that the area under the PDF is equal to the probability of x1 lying between different values, and if you integrate over all values of x1, you have to get 1. The marginal PDF of x2, similarly, you take the joint PDF and you integrate now over x1. So if you've got any multivariate PDF, you find the marginal of any subset of the variables by integrating over all the others. So that still sounds all very dry and abstract mathematics, but this is really quite relevant to situations that physical scientists would be meeting. In fact, you might have heard the phrase before, some of you. We sometimes refer to parameters as nuisance parameters. Anyone heard that before? A few people? So if you've got nuisance parameters, you don't really care what values those have. So what you want to do is to integrate them out over all possible values that they might have. In other words, you want to marginalise over them. And some of the techniques we'll look at tomorrow present a particularly elegant and really incredibly efficient way to marginalise over nuisance parameters, which have allowed us to develop methods like Markov chain Monte Carlo that can deal with problems with huge numbers of parameters. It might be that you're only interested in a few of them, but you can get rid of the importance of all the others by marginalisation. So it's basically integration over the parameters you're not interested in. Conversely, you can look at conditional distributions. Again, this is just extending the ideas that we introduced before the break in first setting up Bayes' theorem. If you've got a joint PDF of x1 and x2, and you observe x1 but you don't observe x2, so you want a function that describes the PDF of x2 given the observed value of x1 that you have, we call that the conditional PDF. So it's the probability of x2 given x1. You normally write it like shown. And Bayes' theorem tells you how to work that out. It's the joint distribution of x1 and x2 divided by the marginal distribution of x1, provided that marginal distribution isn't zero. That would be embarrassing. We would wind up with an infinity. Oops. Nope, I wouldn't want to buy express it. I don't know why it asked me. Okay, so the probability of x1 given x2 is similarly the joint distribution divided by the marginal of x2, and we can extend to more than two random variables in the obvious way. But at least for this course, we're not going to look at any such examples in great depth, because the notation starts to get very clumsy. Okay, so now we come to an application of those ideas to something which is really a big deal in many physics problems. You want to assure yourself that one variable is independent of another variable. Or maybe it might be that you actually want to test what the dependence is of one variable on another. Both situations could be relevant to a whole bunch of physical sciences data analysis problems. So if x1 and x2 are the two variables, and they are independent of each other, then you can write the joint distribution of x1 and x2 as the product of their marginal distributions. So if x1 and x2 are independent of each other, if and only if, the joint PDF of x1 and x2 can be written as the product of their marginal PDFs. I've got one more astronomy example for you. Again, I've tried not to make my examples too field specific, but this one is, I think, a nice way to think about the ideas of statistical independence. So astronomers are interested in looking at galaxies or stars or planets or whatever it might be. And what we do is we look out at the universe and we build big telescopes to do it. But those telescopes can only see so far, because the objects you're looking at are not infinitely bright. It also takes time for the light to travel. So if you're looking at galaxies which are quite luminous, you can see them when they're further away. If they're less luminous, you can't see them when they're quite so far away. In fact, often when I'm talking about this, doing lectures in cosmology, I'm inclined to use a clip from a wonderful Channel 4 comedy series, Father Ted. I haven't got that in my slides today, but I'm sure if you know the series, you'll perhaps know what I'm thinking of. There's a scene where Ted and Dougal are in a caravan, and he holds up a little plastic cow and he says to Dougal, "These are small, while the ones out there are far away." So, of course, only an imbecile like Dougal can fail to grasp the difference between a small plastic cow and a full-size real cow, which is just very far away. But that can be a real problem in astronomy. It can be hard to tell if you're looking at something which is very luminous and far away, or less luminous and nearby. So this diagram here is all about that. A measure of distance that we use in astronomy is called the redshift. Many of you have maybe heard of that before. And we work out the brightness of a galaxy as its luminosity. So as you go further and further away from the Earth, then you can only see galaxies if they're more and more luminous, because all the faint ones aren't visible anymore. Okay? So what this diagram shows is from a survey that one of my grad students was working on a few years ago, just at similar stage to yourself, in first year, and one of the tasks he was doing in his first year was trying to work out if, for this galaxy survey, the luminosity of galaxies was independent of redshift, independent of distance. Now, if you look at this plot, it's obvious that it's dependent on redshift, because if you go over here, you can only see really luminous galaxies, whereas at low redshift, you can see a very wide range of luminosities. But that's not really to do with the galaxies. That's to do with the limitations of our telescope. It's what we call selection effects. And in many areas of the physical sciences, the real problem in doing data analysis is in separating out what you can see from what you would like to see. What you would like to see is an underlying population of objects, whatever they are. It could be galaxies, photons, you know, whatever your field of physics is, you'll have your desired distribution that you want to sample. But the limitations of your equipment mean that you probably can't do that. And you might wind up with something like this. So what you've got to then try and do is to work out whether the underlying population of sources really satisfies a certain property, even though the ones that you can see clearly don't. So you've got to correct for these selection effects. So a lot of Bayesian methods can be applied to that sort of problem, and we'll look at some of them tomorrow. But for the moment, I just want you to think about this question of the independence of luminosity and redshift. So what we had before was the general definition for two quantities, x1 and x2, that if they are statistically independent, you can write their joint distribution as the product of their marginal distributions. And here's some real data where we want to test if that is true. So here's question 4, which is sort of based on that picture that we had before. Because the complication here is that it's not so much the function that causes the problem of the selection effects. It's the range over which you can observe the data. As I said, if you go to large redshift, you can only observe galaxies above a certain luminosity, because all the faint ones are too faint to observe. So here is a little example of a joint distribution, P of X and Y, and I'm going to give you four possible functional forms. But there's only one of them which is statistically independent. Only one where you can write the joint distribution as the product of the marginal distributions. And, you know, again, this is a slightly trickier question. The majority of the multi-choice questions are a bit easier than this, but this one will test whether you're thinking like a Bayesian, thinking like a statistician. There's one of these distributions that we can write, is it D, C, B, or A, as the product of two marginal distributions. Which one do you think it might be? Okay, we'll move on. So final thing I want to do in the next few minutes before we break for lunch is to introduce something called the bivariate normal distribution, and then that, at least for a while, is our sort of toolbox of mathematical functions and so on defined adequately. We can go on with doing some data analysis after lunch. So let's suppose that you've got X and Y, random variables like before, and they've got the joint PDF that takes this form. Looks a bit ugly. You've got sigmas in there, you've got a new thing called rho, I haven't seen that before, and then you've got a quadratic form, Q of X and Y, which involves mu's and sigmas, and it also involves rho. So this is known as the bivariate normal PDF, and it's specified by five different parameters. There's mu X, mu Y, sigma X, sigma Y, and rho. And this PDF is very often used in the physical sciences to model the joint PDF of two random variables. Now, it's a bit easier to think about it in terms of a picture rather than the maths. So here's a picture of a bivariate normal distribution. It's a hill, basically. And the summit of the hill is at mu x and mu y. Those are the mean values of x and y, respectively. Oops, sorry, I thought we had the picture in that next slide as well. Don't know why we don't. So there's the picture, and then I'll go to the definition and I'll flick back to the picture in a sec. So the expected value of x, or the mean value of x, is mu of x. The expected value of y is mu y. The variance of x is sigma x squared. The variance of y is sigma y squared. So that's the four parameters that define the marginal distributions of x and y, but there's a fifth parameter. And the fifth one is called the correlation coefficient, which again is a term you might have met before. It's something that you might even have worked out before using data in undergraduate labs. Formally, it's defined to be the expected value of x minus mu x times y minus mu y. And we define that to be rho times sigma x times sigma y. And if rho equals zero, then x and y are independent. At least they are for a normal distribution. Because for a normal distribution, all the higher order moments can be set to be zero. So independence is the same as a zero correlation coefficient for a normal distribution. More generally, independence isn't the same as uncorrelated. And we'll see that tomorrow. I'll introduce something called independent component analysis, which is a way of analysing non-normal data, non-Gaussian data, which gets around that limitation. There's another method which is normally applied just to Gaussian data or normal data called principal component analysis. Has anyone heard of that? Yeah, well, again, I never get many hands, but in fact, principal component analysis is a fancy term for something that you've kind of probably been doing in data analysis as undergraduates anyway. So we'll look at that tomorrow. Okay, so the expected value of x minus mu x times y minus mu y is known as the covariance, and the correlation coefficient is like a scaled version of the covariance, which is always between minus 1 and plus 1. In fact, you can define the covariance for any two variables. It's the expected value of x minus e of x times y minus e of y. And tomorrow, we'll spend quite a lot of time talking about something called the covariance matrix, which is closely related to something else called the Fisher information matrix, which is very, very important in designing experiments. So more on that tomorrow. Here's some pictures of the bivariate normal distribution. What we're doing here is just taking slices through the hill for different values of rho. So when rho is zero, the contours are circles. But when rho is different from zero, the contours become increasingly elongated. And that's because there's a correlation, a non-zero correlation, between x and y. If it's a positive correlation, then that means that y tends to increase as x increases. So if you go to the right of the mean in x, then generally you expect y also to be above the mean. Whereas if there's a negative correlation, then y tends to decrease as x increases. So the contours slope the other way. So very often in physical sciences, what you're interested in doing is evaluating the strength of the correlation between two different quantities. So measuring this correlation coefficient is one way to do that. And for example, you might want to test whether the correlation coefficient is zero, because it might be that in your theory, you expect this variable to be uncorrelated with that variable. But you go and measure it for your data, and you don't get zero, you get 0.5 or 0.6. So you have to tear up your theory and start again. We'll look this afternoon at ways in which you could perform what we call a hypothesis test to see whether a given value of any parameter, but this is one such example, the correlation coefficient, is supported by your data. The contours become narrower and steeper as rho tends to 1, either 1 or minus 1. That means you're getting a stronger anti-correlation between x and y, or in other words, if you specify the value of x, then there's a narrower range of values of y which are kind of permitted by the distribution, which again might be exactly the sort of thing you're looking for in your physical model to support your theory or rule out somebody else's theory. So this bivariate normal distribution is very, very useful. It has its limits, but in many physical sciences situations, this is what we use. And after lunch, we're going to look at least squares, which I'm sure you've all met before as undergrads, maybe used before. If you haven't, don't worry. We'll very quickly go through it from first principles. But what I want to let you see is the connection between least squares, straight line fitting, the kind of thing you've done perhaps as undergrads plenty of times already, and doing that same kind of model fitting in more generalised situations. So the first step towards that is defining this bivariate normal. The marginal PDFs of x and y are just the single univariate normals with mean mu x, mean mu y. And the conditional PDF of y given x is also a normal distribution. And there's a corresponding expression for x given y. And maybe a more helpful way to think about that is that the mean value of the conditional distribution, which you could call the conditional expectation, has got the equation of a straight line. So in fact, when you do a least squares fit, which you've maybe done for years as undergrads, what you're really doing formally is you're working out the conditional PDF of a bivariate normal distribution. Well, the fancy term for that is you're doing a regression of y on x. We call this the regression line. So after lunch, we'll look at more general ways of doing least squares and how all this fits in to this simple description of univariate and bivariate and indeed multivariate distributions.